So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Considering this is supposed to be a monumental occasion, being that it's Y2J's first WWF pay-per-view appearance, I gotta be honest with you, I'm disappointed. I mean, I didn't think it was possible for the WWF to top the tediousness of Raw is Snore, but they have done so with this ridiculous ripoff of a pay-per-view that I call Summer Sham. And the worst thing of all is you people got conned into wasting your money, and now you all look like a bunch of fools. I mean, look at the boring list of matches featuring a bunch of useless performers, the worst of which is standing in the ring right now.
It is review away. It is the summer, and it's time for Wei and I to have an out-of-body experience.
Oh, that's what you think of when you think of summers.
Yes.
Ghosts. Spirits.
That was also the tagline for this pay-per-view.
Ah, yes.
An out-of-body experience.
I get it, because...
He's Jesse the Body Ventura.
The Body. I guess he had a pretty impressive body.
He did. And once he got a lot of flack for being the governor and doing this, they decided to refer to him more as Jesse the Body Ventura rather than Governor Ventura.
As if that makes a difference.
It made a huge difference.
He's a completely different person.
Wei, how are you?
I'm good.
The summer is winding down rapidly.
Yeah, I know.
It's almost over. It felt like it just began.
I know. Have you got out to the beach lately? Have you enjoyed this weather?
I have not been to the beach. I've barely ever gone to the beach in Toronto.
Really?
No, I'm not a beach person here in the city. I don't think people really think of Toronto as a place that would have a beach, but they do.
We do have a beach. I mean, I wouldn't advise getting into the water.
No,
but we do have a beach, although barely this year because we did have it flooded. So
you'll literally have an out-of-body experience because many things will be coming out of your body if you go into that water.
I'm sure there are some bodies in the water too.
Could be too as well. Yeah. It is a dumping ground. Well, Wei. This is what we were given. We threw out four options. We were given this one. We're going to 1999.
Uh-huh.
Really, when you look at the Attitude Era, this was a big, big part of it was the summer of 1999. Not their biggest year when it comes to revenue they brought in, but I feel in terms of sheer popularity that this was about that point. In time was mid-99. It was super hot. This was also just days before the launch of SmackDown. And yeah, the company was on fire heading into SummerSlam.
2 weeks right after Chris Jericho's debut.
And great slot for Chris Jericho here in his first ever SummerSlam event.
Oh, yes, of course.
You
say that with zero sarcasm. Okay, so where were we at in terms of the Monday Night Wars? Where was WCW at ratings-wise?
Well, WCW had definitely gone down. This was after all of the insanity from the first half of 1999, and this was the tail end of Kevin Nash as Booker because we were still 2 months to go until Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara would come in.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point in WCW, they were coming off a horrendous – Road Wild pay-per-view where Kevin Nash lost a retirement match to Hulk Hogan.
Mm.
The end of his career.
Wow. Yes.
Hulk Hogan had reverted back to the red and yellow this summer. It was not a great time, but it wasn't dead. It was not dead yet in mid 1999.
Interesting.
You still had all your younger talent. Jericho, of course, had left, but WWF was well ahead here. This was far removed from the days of, Tuesday afternoon being dramatic as to who was going to be winning the Monday Night War.
Very impressive that you just know all this off the top of your head. I mean, I don't talk about this stuff with John beforehand. He has no notes to refer to. I just throw these out there to test him, and you pass.
Well, how do you know I passed? What if I just made all that up?
Well, I guess we'll find out. We'll find out in the fact-checking thread, won't we? Or you'll find out. You'll find out on Twitter.
I was going to joke that we're definitely not going to review that Road Wild event, but I believe we have reviewed that Road Wild event in history.
Oh, okay.
Pretty awful. SummerSlam 1999.
Let's do it.
We're going to have a great discussion at the end of the show debating where this ranks amongst the worst SummerSlam events. And maybe you're going to be a little bit surprised by my analysis at the end of this.
Oh, okay.
So we're going to find out. Wei, I came into your office a few days ago and you had this on well in advance of our review. And like I almost needed to bring a mop in to take care of the life that had melted off of you onto your floor. You seemed dead watching this event, and you were 45 minutes into it. Mm. How long did this take you to watch, and how painful was the final 2 hours?
Well, I set aside my afternoon to watch this, and what was it, like a 2.5 hour, 3 hour show?
This was it was just under 2 hours and 40 minutes, which by WWF standards – even short for the time period, but I mean, compared to today, where you get 3 hours full on a pay-per-view, yeah, sometimes an overrun, you get a kickoff. This year, a 2 hour kickoff. My God, this was nothing.
I guess not, but, I mean, I'm watching this show and I think I ended up sleeping like on three occasions. So I had to rewind. Every time I fall asleep watching the show, and this happens a lot more, especially with old reviewaways, that's why I like doing the live shows more. I almost prefer to do a Raw and a SmackDown because I gotta follow that time. Like, I have to follow that schedule. You know what I mean? But when I watch these shows, I know I can take my time, and if I know I miss something, I can go back to watch it. So having to do that repeatedly, I would say this probably took like 6 hours.
6 hours, yeah, to watch. I needed multiple sittings for this show. I knew I was not getting through this in one or two. I knew I was going to have to break this one up. So we're going to get right into it. SummerSlam 1999 from Sunday, August 22nd at the Target Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, a chain that attempted to expand into Canada over the last few years.
Yes.
Had you ever watched this SummerSlam?
I don't think so.
This follows the pattern of when WWF was very hot, Wei was not watching.
Not
when it
really
slipped down, Wei was all in.
Yeah.
So this was, you were really out of it at this point.
Yeah, pretty much.
99. So opening video started with highlights from past matches involving Steve Austin with nefarious guest referees. We had Mike Tyson at WrestleMania 14 that ended up assisting one Steve Austin. Then we had Vince McMahon trying to get the title off of Austin at the 1998 Over the Edge pay-per-view. And then fast forward to Over the Edge 1999 with Shane McMahon fast counting Steve Austin, which was a clip Kevin Owens did not find on SmackDown this week.
Oh.
Another incident of Shane, and probably the only time in the history of this show, Wei, that we have referenced Over the Edge 1999 for something else that happened on the show.
I'm surprised they would even show it.
It felt weird that they were even using that show. Remember, this was only a few months afterwards,
yeah,
that they're referencing this show that is synonymous with Owen Hart to just set up a video package. They did do a WWF title switch in the main event of that show, which,
ugh,
God, if ever there was an audible to call, it was probably that one of doing a significant title change in the main event of that show, which, I mean, I criticized it when they did, but they did put it up on the network when they launched it.
Well, I mean, it didn't even seem like this was all that necessary to show that clip. Your whole point of this video package was to show that there has been a recent history of bad refereeing as it relates to Steve Austin matches. And couldn't they have pulled out another clip like the one that Kevin Owens actually
Survivor Series 98 could have easily been used to showcase Shane fucking Austin. And the idea here was, and you know, these clips, if anything, the Tyson one was a referee helping Steve Austin, not screwing him.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of didn't, that one was the most popular, but didn't really tell this story of all these refs that have screwed Austin, and now you have Jesse, and the buck stops with Jesse Ventura,
perhaps,
the governor.
Perhaps it's to show that bad refereeing has taken place, period. And here's Jesse the Body Ventura to put an end to it.
So this was a show that legitimately sold out in 90 minutes when tickets went on sale. 15,973 paid, and a gate of $557,129, which, given the way they have scaled prices today, that gate figure would be so much more bigger today. Like, it shows you that there was, you had a ton of people, but, you know, $600,000 gate. It's like, they could do that no problem.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, was it just cheaper tickets?
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
How cheap?
Enough that you had 17,000 here all in.
Let me do that math.
Well, do the 15,000 because that's the paid attendance.
Okay.
15,973. Or no, sorry, do the gate figure first.
Okay, tell me the number.
557,129.
Divided by?
15,973. So per head.
So that's an average price of $35.
That's crazy.
A ticket?
I was looking the other day at SummerSlam tickets for the Barclays Center.
Yeah.
Dude, there are individuals on Ticketmaster going for thousands per ticket.
Wow.
Thousands.
Incredible. I mean, but the fact
takeover, that complete opposite.
$35 a ticket suggests that there are a lot of tickets probably cheaper, way cheaper than even $35.
Oh, for sure. I mean, wow. Probably you could get in 99. I remember for house shows, you could get front row for, or like close under 100. Like that was kind of where.
Interesting.
At least in the Toronto market. Hmm. So anyway, my point is.
Like you can't even get into an indie show for that price these days.
Oh, it's super expensive. I'm sure PWG, they wouldn't be scaling their prices at 99 levels from the WWF. Business was so hot at this time, they had pyro.
Yeah.
Real big sign of where things were.
Well, geez, that's probably $100,000 of your gross right there.
The announcers are, of course, Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, and Ross announces the summer of 1999 is here on August 22nd. Hurry up. It's almost over. He notes we will have 6 title matches tonight and the quick sellout of the Target Center. We immediately go backstage. There were a series of meetings that Jesse Ventura had with the participants of our main event triple threat match. And first he's meeting with Triple H along with his two best friends at the time, China and his leather Kangol hat.
Yeah, that was a look for him.
Hunter's fashion was amazing in 1999. The highlight coming later, the unbelievable
evolution phase,
the chain kind of vest that he wore.
Oh, okay.
For his big main event.
Oh, you know what? He's a risk taker.
We have reviewed in the past some of the Raws going into this show. We definitely reviewed the Jericho debut.
I'll tell you why I know that for a fact, because at the opening highlight package, they played the clip of China.
Try me, Triple H. Try me.
I only know that clip because of your impression of it. Oh, my God.
So, my God, I was just looking back. I went through the Raw going into this SummerSlam. And, man, like this booking was insane, which, I mean, you look at the time, they were super popular. They could do no wrong, mm-hmm. So it's hard to criticize. But we started off with a Steve Austin, Triple H main event for SummerSlam. Then on the Raw we reviewed with Jericho's debut, that was the one where they set up this Triple H China Undertaker three-way where China pinned Triple H and we were left with it being set up for a week that you would get Austin and China at SummerSlam. So in this one episode of Raw, Hunter demanded he get his spot back and it led to China facing Triple H in a rematch. China wins after Mankind makes his return from surgery and attacks Hunter. That leads to China versus Mankind for the number one contender spot China wins that match. Then they make a final three-way match. Sorry. Then Hunter. Holy Christ.
Good luck.
I can't remember. It ends in a three-way and there's a disputed finish and it ends up with Hunter and Mankind and China is eliminated. Maybe it was Mankind beat China and then Hunter faced Mankind and there was a non-finish. Holy Christ. This was all in the go-home show to set up this main event three-way. My head is spinning.
Now do it backwards.
I can't. I can't at all. This would drive me nuts today as it did back then. So we've got our three-way. Earlier in the day, Chris Jericho was in the parking lot. And Howard Finkel runs up, and at this point, Howard Finkel was playing Ralphus. He was referred to as Harold, and Jericho says Finkel needs to be on time. It's all about impact, Howard. Impact. Cut to Jeff Jarrett.
Mm-hmm.
This was the best segue on the show.
It was.
And Jeff Jarrett is coming out for the opening match to take on dual champion D'Lo Brown. And Jeff Jarrett is accompanied by Deborah. Who is
accompanied by
her bikini.
Yes.
And little else.
Uh-huh.
She was ready for the summer, I guess.
I guess so.
It's warm in Minneapolis.
Yeah, the beach is that way.
Jarrett berates her and sends Deborah to the back, and the fans are so upset, and they are all chanting asshole at Jeff Jarrett. This was gigantic, the heat this guy got. They cut to the back. Deborah is with D'Lo. And now D'Lo brings out Deborah, and the place goes nuts. Ross notes everyone is cheering for the youngster D'Lo, and then Lawler sets the record straight. They are definitely cheering for the puppies.
Mm-hmm.
D'Lo ain't over. Those breasts are over.
And D'Lo was the, I guess the escorter of the puppies.
He let the dogs out.
It was really – anytime I go back to these Attitude Era shows – I think I'm always a little taken aback at how horny these crowds were. Like, it was like...
Or how horny this color commentator was?
The commentator was only reflecting what he was seeing in this audience. And it was this audience that was... I mean, maybe it's, you know, it's the chicken or the egg, right? But they certainly... I mean, shit, I guess this was before, like, the internet... speeds got that fast and internet porn was like that big of a thing, but you would imagine that this audience had never seen exposed breasts before.
So of course Jeff Jarrett had been, I mean, he was teaming with Owen Hart, and then they were starting to tease the breakup when Owen died. And then after that, I mean, it was Jeff Jarrett was just, I mean, for his whole tenure, he was given so much to just try and get over. And then at this point, I mean, pairing him with Deborah, I mean, Deborah was more over than Jeff was. Yeah. And then they'd start to get into Jeff just attacking all the women with guitar shots, and that would lead into the China feud. And then he left the company. And it was just, he had all these gimmicks, all these ideas thrown to just try and get this guy over. And in reality, I mean, he was a fine middle-of-the-card player.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was seen in WCW as well. I never viewed him as a top-level guy.
Quite honestly, it was seen in TNA as well, even when he spent all that time at the top. But, I mean, Jarrett, I think history will look at him not so much as, you know, for what he's done in-ring, but for what he's done outside of the ring.
So, I mean, nonetheless, a lot of heel heat for him here in front of this Minneapolis crowd.
He was trying to cover Deborah up.
This was also, to me, the peak of D'Lo Brown, who I was really high on at this point in the in the summer. Like, he was starting to break out, good worker, and to me, his career just spiraled after the Darren Drozdov incident that would happen just a few months after this.
Yeah.
And he never recovered from that. But in this summer, I mean, he felt like someone that was on the rise.
Mm-hmm.
So the match begins. Crowd was all into D'Lo's offense. Jarrett leapt up, caught him with a sit-out powerbomb. Brown leaped into the off the turnbuckle, and Jarrett basically just fell over to his side with a suplex in midair. Brown then runs into the post on the floor, and there's this camera on the apron that just tilts down right on top of Deborah's cleavage, and Lawler's losing it. Just, the guy's going to have an orgasm right here in match number one. There was a running power bomb by D'Lo, leg drop for a near fall by Brown. He then calls for the frog splash and ends up missing with a top rope somersault. Jarrett grabs a guitar, but then Mark Henry, D'Lo's best friend who he's been trying to get to lose weight, runs in, takes the guitar from Jeff Jarrett, and this was the classic Vince Russo turn. There was no question where Vince Russo still was in his career with this one. And Henry just is sizing up the guitar, twisting it around, and then boom, he nails D'Lo from behind while Tim White is distracted with Deborah, and Jarrett just gets on top and pins him in 7 minutes, 29 seconds, and both Deborah and Mark Henry were in on it all along with Jeff Jarrett, and Jarrett is now the dual Intercontinental and European champion. A feat that would last all of 24 hours before Jarrett handed the title to Mark Henry to give him the European title.
Oh, well, that's nice.
And Way, this was one of the better matches on the show. So I don't know if that's a good sign or an extremely bad one for what was to come. But it was, man.
It was a match and an angle that honestly is not really worth your time to revisit. Just a convoluted, standard, cliched pro wrestling heel turn.
Mark Henry was so upset that this guy tried to save his life.
Yeah, I would say unless you really love D'Lo or Jeff Jarrett or puppies, you don't need to watch this.
This was, like, if you're separating good matches from bad matches on this show, this is in the upper half.
Yeah.
Michael Cole was backstage with Edge and Christian from earlier in the day, and we've got a tag turmoil match where the winning team will get a tag title shot tomorrow night on Raw. They drew number one. They're tired of following Gangrel's lead. They outgrew him. And they say the blood that spews will be the new brood and Gangrel's blood.
It was really interesting to see Edge and Christian in this current incarnation. Right after they had just left the Brood and before they had found their kind of awesomeness gimmick, where they were clearly just still trying to find their own identities, especially Christian, who I think
they needed flashlights at this point.
For almost his entire time in the Brood, never spoke a word. Here, he was just starting to talk. And it's really interesting to see these two before their personalities took hold. And it kind of makes you think of guys currently like Jason Jordan and Chad Gable, you know, who are in similar situations where they are given TV time but don't really know who they are. And it's amazing to see people like Edge and Christian, who we know so much for their personalities now, be in a similar state.
So then we had this unique tag team turmoil match, and the first match was Edge and Christian against the New Brood, which is easily forgotten and for good reason with the Hardys. And this was their minor run with Gangrel before they would end up leaving Gangrel for Terry as just the Hardys.
Mm-hmm.
Edge and Christian entered through the crowd while the Hardys' entrance was that they would come out and bow their heads as Gangrel would spit out blood.
Yeah.
Christian was wrestling in a giant unbuttoned shirt. Gangrel nailed Christian from the floor. Matt had the cover. The crowd was actually not that into this at the beginning.
This was Edge and Christian versus the Hardys on paper, yes, but this was before the Terry Invitational. This was before any of them had any personality.
No, but they had had matches at this point. I mean, but they were not notable? Focused upon.
Yeah, like were the matches even that memorable?
This wasn't bad at all. For 5 minutes?
Was it memorable?
No.
This was a 205 Live match, if that.
Well, the Hardys took their shirts off, and there were actually some boos. Jeff hit a springboard into a split-legged moonsault. There was a poetry in motion to Christian. Jeff hit a swanton to Christian, but Edge made the save. Christian then hit a double inverted DDT. That got the first reaction of the match. Hot tag to Edge. Edge and Jeff then did the spot that the cameras did not capture enough, where they ran opposite ends of the barricade and ended with Edge spearing him in midair. I thought this looked great. And then Christian did a crossbody off the turnbuckle to the floor. Matt followed with a moonsault. And then Edge hit an electric chair onto the chest of Matt. And Christian followed with a top rope elbow drop. And they won in 5 minutes and 3 seconds. I thought these guys maximized their 5 minutes as much as they could.
Crowd, I thought the high spots ultimately kind of got them somewhat into it. But amazing to see this crowd not care really about these two legendary teams at this point in their careers. Even the shirts taking off, got no reaction.
Nothing. It was sad. Think of the change, like in 1 year's time.
Oh, yeah.
To SummerSlam 2000.
It really is quite amazing what that, I would say that ladder match really set the tone for the identities of both these teams and their styles that were to come in the following years.
So then we got into the meat of the WWF's tag division. Next was Edge and Christian against Viscera.
I had no clue this was a gauntlet. I thought this was just a regular tag match.
No, you got to see what the tag division had to offer.
Yeah.
And again, think of 1999 versus 2000 and how that tag division turned around, because this was brutal. Jim Ross suggests we may not see the same high risk offense from the Hardys as we will from Viscera and Midian. Viscera actually hit a spinning heel kick to Edge. Impressive, he got off his feet. Edge pulled Midian into the corner. Viscera splashed him by mistake, and then a double shoulder tackle sent Viscera to the floor, and Edge speared Midian in 2 minutes and 2 seconds.
Starting to build that reaction for Edge and Christian. Underdogs, clearly.
Then they took on Prince Albert and Draws.
Yeah.
Albert hit a spinning neck breaker to Edge off the shoulders. Albert then goes for a military press, but Christian clipped the knee and Edge hit the downward spiral, pinning Albert in a minute 48. This was like your standard Raw match at the time, because that's about the length the Raw matches would go outside of your main event. And then the final team was the Acolytes.
No, not the final team.
Oh, you're right. There were two more teams. The Acolytes immediately entered as the last match ended. There was a missile dropkick by Edge to Bradshaw as Farouk and Christian brawled on the floor. Bradshaw then powerbombed out of the corner, delivering that to Edge. They beat down on Edge. There was a spinebuster by Farouk. Farouk crotched Christian on the top turnbuckle, recovered to hit a tornado DDT to Bradshaw for a near fall, and then there was a wheelbarrow splash to Bradshaw for a two count. And then the Hollies run out, not realizing the match has yet to finish, and then Bradshaw hits a clothesline from hell, telling Christian, we got to go home, and pin Christian in 4 minutes and 56 seconds.
This was really odd. I don't know if the Hardys were just given a cue to get out there.
Hollies.
Too. Yeah, the Hollies.
He said the Hardys.
No, the
Hollies. Okay, Hollies.
I meant to say the Hollies. I don't know if they were just given a miscue to come out too quick. I've never seen that happen before, even in a gauntlet match. The pinfall didn't even occur yet, and these guys were out waiting to jump in.
They should really have an instrument that makes a noise when a match ends.
Oh, sure. Maybe a didgeridoo.
What's that?
It's like I believe it's like an Australian instrument. It just goes like, makes like a, you blow into it and it makes like a low bassy. Ooh.
The match is over. Or just use a bell.
That should be he should do the announcement. Oh, you're terrible. I think, also, I mean, they were, very clearly trying to build up Edge and Christian as the underdogs that are lasting through all these teams.
I think they saw the talent those two had and was like, let's get them through, but they're not being our push tag team.
So who the fuck were the push tag teams here?
Well, the Hollies had just been put together on the Monday going into this show.
Yeah.
And the Acolytes were still a featured team. So it was like those, to me, were the
– Those were your biggest teams?
They were the final two.
That made no sense to me, because the crowd is starting to get behind Edge and Christian. The moment that they left, this crowd had nobody else to cheer for, and you can tell by the reaction in this last match.
Well, the Hollies and the Acolytes had a 2 minute and 52 second final. The Hollies immediately attacked them. There was a Dominator delivered to Crash, hardcore attack from behind. There was a double shoulder block to Hardcore Holly. Crowd did not care. Hardcore and Crash start arguing and fighting, which was their gimmick. Crash got sent to the floor. Hardcore turns around into a spinebuster and is pinned by Farouk. Crash and Hardcore continued to argue. If you were upset that Edge and Christian did not win this match 18 years ago, this led to a tag title match the next night that went about 2 minutes with no finish. So it meant nothing in the grand scheme of things.
Great. Whoa, awesome.
What a tag team turmoil. Yeah. The Undertaker and Big Show arrived late. And Taker sporting his wallet chain in 1999.
Now, what was this? Because Taker, wasn't he still doing the ministry thing?
This was where he was kind of phasing out of the ministry gimmick. He wasn't a biker. He was still the satanic Undertaker. Yeah. But he wasn't wearing the big robe anymore. He didn't even have the ministry
at this point.
They had kind of gone their separate ways.
But I was surprised to see him in this backstage opening thing of him just coming out in his street clothes.
Well, I don't know this, but it felt like he was on his way. I'm sure he had that biker gimmick in mind.
Yeah.
It was shortly after this show that he'd end up having to go away for 9 months for a groin surgery and then returned as the biker gimmick. So it felt like he was just trying to prolong his time until he needed this surgery, and the gimmick for the biker was there.
He was slowly becoming more human.
Slowly. Yeah, you can't just overnight.
It all
human.
Starts with the chain. Yeah. You know, every human, every zombie transformation to human comes with the biker chain.
Now, the guy next to him, like, Big Show's gimmick was like he was this dead weight, essentially. Like, he was this failure. And my God, on the Raw that preceded this show, it features these two in the ring with The Undertaker cutting hands down the worst promo of his career. It never ended. It was, we're going to end the show with it.
Oh,
it was
okay.
So awful.
I kind of want to hear it now.
But the idea was that Big Show was taken under The Undertaker's wing, and Taker just looks at him as his fuck up, which, if you've heard Big Show do interviews, was kind of what their relationship was behind the scenes.
Right.
That The Undertaker had taken this guy under his wing and just.
He's Enzo.
Kind of. Yeah. And he may have been thrown off a bus during this time as well. Like, Big Show, they just looked at him as this guy with all this potential that was not ready for this spot and was nowhere near where people thought he should have been by the time. I mean, he debuted in February, and by the summer, the specialness of the Big Show had worn off in record-setting fashion. And here he is, paired with The Undertaker in this tag team. Then we had a segment with Al Snow and his dog Pepper, and Snow was communicating with Pepper and can also hear him. Road Dog comes out in his 1999 summer line.
Back-to-back dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah, what was he wearing?
This one was not fed to Al Snow.
What was he wearing?
Oh, was there a mistake. That's what he was wearing.
Was there a bucket hat?
No, he didn't have a hat on.
Oh.
He came out in all white. He had a Tommy Hilfiger t-shirt. A white Tommy Hilfiger t-shirt with white shorts, Air Jordans, a fanny pack, and these like yellow tinted glasses. I mean, he screamed like Smash Mouth tribute band reject in 1999.
You think he still dresses like that when he heads to SmackDown? Leading those meetings?
I hope that none of this attire still exists for anybody, much less Brian James. He said that there are two people in the back that are happy that pencils have erasers and he's not in the hardcore title match, because while it was never announced, the original plan was to do a three-way for the hardcore title. And I don't know the story about why he wasn't used for that, but it ended up that he was used as the commentator, the roving reporter for the hardcore title match, and then to do this segment with Chris Jericho. And he challenges the winner of the hardcore title match on that RAW.
Mm-hmm.
So Chris Jericho interrupts, and he appears on the Lion's Den structure, which reminded all of us what was still to come. And Chris Jericho, arguably one of the hottest commodities in wrestling, was making his first pay-per-view appearance for a promo. And he is disappointed. He calls this summer sham, that these people got conned into wasting their money, and calls the matches boring with useless performers. And the worst of all is Road Dog, because no one cares about him. Mocks Road Dog and spells his name, says that's not that impressive. Why don't you spell lugubrious? And then makes fun of his clothing. Like, this guy was reading my mind, from his assessment of the show to the matches to this guy's fashion apparel. He mocks his Stevie Wonder haircut and says that Road Dog is dyslexic, because when he says it sucks, or sorry, when he says suck it, he really means it sucks. Anyway, that was the promo, and tells Road Dog to never bore these people again. So after this like 5 minute shutdown, Road Dog's comeback, not exactly Nas level.
Hey, why don't you shut up, bitch?
See, I prefer that. Sometimes short and sweet is better than a 5-minute thing.
So you like Road Dogg more than Jericho?
I thought Jericho went on too long here. You know, maybe it's because I am a much bigger fan of the current Chris Jericho than I am of this incarnation. Still, I would say, you know, he's entertaining. He was entertaining in WCW, but I would stay very kind of sloppy and kind of unfocused. He had some good lines, but like his delivery didn't feel all that polished. It was the Chris Jericho that was directly lifted from his WCW days, complete with the clothing, the hairstyle, the Ralphus thing. I thought Road Dogg actually was quite good, very charismatic, and I felt like Road Dogg had a more controlled, confident delivery.
In hindsight, do you feel that this show suffered by not having Chris Jericho in an actual match?
Not necessarily, because even if he did have a match, what kind of a match would it have been? 5-minute match? Nothing? It would have been nothing but an exhibition match anyway.
Well,
it wouldn't have saved this show.
Yeah, he ended up having his first television match later that week on SmackDown with Road Dogg. So that ended the segment, and that was all of Chris Jericho for the show. And Road Dogg then joined Lawler and Ross on commentary and explains he doesn't have a computer. So Y2K and Y2J don't mean a thing to him. Which, if you follow him on Twitter, you know he definitely has a computer now, or at least a phone. Big Boss Man and Al Snow for the hardcore title. Their legendary feud. This was our second of 3 consecutive pay-per-view matches, which everyone knows what it culminated in the following month. So Al Snow hides on a forklift, which was part of the set. I really didn't get this set. Like, you had like a construction set for SummerSlam. It really did not have any connection to SummerSlam or Minnesota.
This construction takes place in the summers, not when it's snowing.
Felt like this card was under construction maybe and was definitely not finished. Snow jumped Boss Man, who uses a chair, and then Road Dogg picks up the microphone and he follows them to do live commentary as they go backstage. And Al Snow gets hit with an object, and Road Dogg says, "That was fake." Apparently, they found Dean Douglas's chalkboard, and then an empty dog case is thrown by Boss Man to leave the viewer with the idea that Pepper was inside and could be dead. That would be a few television shows from now. There was a guy randomly on crutches backstage that were taken out from underneath him. They also fought by a Pepsi fridge that got destroyed. The garage opens, so they fight into traffic across the street, and then they head into a bar. They fought into the washroom. A urinal cake was used. Al Snow got a chain, which who goes to a bar without a disposable chain? Starts choking Boss Man. Al Snow did a moonsault off the bar through the table, and amazingly, all these patrons had WWF merchandise on. But not enough to go to the show across the street. Guess the sellout was just too tough to get tickets for. Boss Man gets cut open. They're in they're in the pool area, and Road Dogg nails Boss Man with a nightstick. Al Snow uses these pool balls and then just pins Boss Man in 7:26 and runs back to the arena where Stevie Richards and the Blue Meanie are by this car. They take the other crutch out from the guy and attack him.
Yes, right. I think it was about 3:00 in the afternoon. I was about an hour in, and I had my first nap.
Nothing like a 1999 hardcore match to really put you to sleep.
God damn. Man, I'll say like visually there are moments that were fun in this, and I think that's what all these WWE plunder matches are good for. They're visual gags. But this went on for too long. Eventually, you just kind of get sick of like seeing guys sloppily fake attack each other with random objects, and I was just ready for this thing to wrap up a little quicker.
And it was also, I mean, there was a small window where these were novel to watch because of the creativity some of the guys had. The Al Snow Road Dogg brawl, where they brawl outside, and you know, like there was some stuff for the first time, it was unique, but they were doing this every single week, and there was another 3 years of these matches to go.
And not much of it was creative.
No.
A lot of it was just like, oh, here's a funny object. Hit me in the head with it.
Yeah, it. I I quickly got tired of the hardcore division. The WWF did not, but I was so happy when that title was eliminated. Jesse Ventura met with Mankind, who says that a pinfall has to take place in the ring, but Mankind just wants to talk about Geraldine Ferraro as a viable candidate who Ventura calls a bleeding heart liberal.
Okay.
Ivory and Tori were next.
Mm-hmm.
This was set up on Sunday Night Heat with an attack where Ivory got shoe polish and wrote slut on the front of Tori and skank on the back. So there was no escaping either insult for Tori.
That would take a while to write. That's like 10 nine letters.
This would also be repeated with Trish Stratus and Christy Hemme years later, which we discussed at the time that Trish Stratus's penmanship at the time, outstanding. Ivory's, not as much. Tori ran to the ring as Jim Ross does a warning that this will not be scientific. The crowd was still clearly in awe of what they had just seen with the previous hardcore match, that they were quiet for this.
Somebody in the crowd held up a sign promoting their nude chicks website.
gotta capitalize on those camera seats.
Another sign read, "I poop too much."
There were a number of stupid signs which you can spend hours with on a 1999 WWF program.
It's an argument for confiscation.
That's for sure. It really is. Then Ivory yelled, "Get ready for the big swing," as she lifted up Tori and swung her around.
How many counts?
So I think I got to 2 1/4, which was the only time 2 1/4 would be used to describe this match.
This was so bad.
Then we saw this tackle by Ivory, which Jim Ross, I'm sorry, but I got to call 2 minutes for reaching here, called it an edge-like spear. Jerry Lawler howls with laughter and tells Ross to check his vision. Edge-like spear. Like, he basically says, please, don't do that disservice to one Adam Copeland. And then we saw what, in my mind, is the worst sunset flip in history, delivered by Tori, where she fell over top and then Ivory just sat on top of her like earthquake and pinned her in 4 minutes and 10 seconds. You could not come up with a worse looking end to a match. This was brutal.
Yeah. This is not a good match at all.
This had to be on a show that had many candidates. This was the worst match on the show by a country mile.
I mean, I try to think about it. If this match took place in present day, it would get
these women would be sent down. I mean, like television would be just.
Like, think about, like, a Lana – who like, if Lana and Carmella had a match, do you think it would be this
bad? No, I don't. I really don't think it would be
this
bad.
That's amazing to me. And here you have Ivory, who I think is a pretty capable wrestler,
Ivory was competent. Yeah. Tori was awful.
Yeah.
So there you have it. That was our 4-minute, 10-second match. And then Ivory tore off Tori's pants and undid her top until Luna runs out and chased Ivory to the back.
No, you really can't blame this crowd for chanting "take it off" in these matches.
When the women are like, okay.
When, I mean, that's exactly what they're catering towards. They're building the match around, you know, somebody stripping somebody else. And the word "skank" being spray painted on their back.
Imagine that it had been like this permanent ink that was used and Tori had to wrestle this match with.
Imagine, forget going to the beach, I guess.
Oh, that'd be really tough. Couldn't hang out with Deborah. Michael Cole was with The Rock. So The Rock takes the microphone and he interviews Michael Cole and got in his 99 gay jokes and then cut a promo on Billy Gunn.
<He did. laughs>
Like, that was the substance of this, was that all? Jokes. You're really weird. You might be gay. Are you gay?
The Rock says this. He sees the way you look at The Rock. For the past 3 years, The Rock just wants to know this. Are you a little kumsi kumsa?
No.
It doesn't matter if you are kumsi or kumsa or not.
Are you staring at me in a sexual way, Michael Cole?
He might be the next president here.
The future president who may have some of these 1999 promos come back and bite him in the ass, which would not be cool with The Rock of 99.
No.
Billy Gunn is then shown bringing a mystery person that is all covered up backstage. This was an awful show.
This was
the second biggest match of the show.
This was like somebody, a social studies class would have a field day picking this apart.
I was so embarrassed watching so much of this on this show. Huh. Like I would have a hard time.
Yeah.
Just, man. We talk about when, you know, people will ask you like, oh, what do you do? Oh, wrestling. It's like,
and you,
man.
You try to talk about the G1. You talk about some of the great storytelling, like, Steamboat Flair. But then you have shows like this.
Can you imagine being Jeff Merrick in the summer of 1999? It's like, oh, we got to recap the slut angle, the defacing of Tori's body with shoe polish.
I could see why he left.
And Michael Cole being called gay. So we had a video for the next match, including Steve Blackman trying to run Ken Shamrock over with a car. Steve Blackman, at one time the trainer for one Dennis Bermudez of the UFC.
You laugh, but they just did that at the last pay-per-view.
Yeah, it was Braun was more violent than Steve Blackman was. Maybe that's where a Lion's Den match will come back for Roman and Braun, because the Last Man Standing match was a little inconclusive. Blackman, okay, do you want to explain the Lion's Den match? This is the second straight SummerSlam. They have brought out the, I believe, hexagonal structure.
I don't know if there's that much to explain. This is essentially kind of their version of the octagon with higher kind of sides. And, of course, there are weapons in there.
You know why this was a really stupid match?
Because in MMA, they never use weapons.
Yes, but had Campbell McLaren stuck with the UFC, they may have.
Oh, okay.
But think about what we just went over of how fast tickets sold out. And this structure invariably cut off seats, prime seats.
You think so?
This took up room on the floor.
Yeah, but they kind of have that open space typically anyway.
I feel this was big enough, though. I mean, you had all your equipment around it. If this took up one seat, this match did not draw anything worth the price of that seat.
$35.
So Blackman has nunchucks in the back of his pants. This was also, in a trivia note, Ken Shamrock's final WWF pay-per-view.
Oh, is that right?
He never came back.
So what did he – he went to Pride after this?
He did a few more TVs and was set to do a program with Chris Jericho, but that's when he got the – massive Pride offer, and it made sense for Ken to do that at the time.
Yeah,
and never came back.
Are you surprised Ken never came back to the WWE, or they never asked him to come back?
I think by the time Ken would have been willing to, the WWF had no interest in him. And
even when he was like feuding with Tito and did those big numbers on Spike,
but he contractually couldn't have at that time.
Yeah, I guess.
And by the time it was 2008, 2009, remember 2009, he failed his drug test. He was a lot older.
Yeah.
I don't think they had any interest. I don't think Ken was ever to them that level of star that, I mean, he was just never someone you ever heard whispers of that they had any interest in. And now Ken, I mean, God, he's public about it in all his interviews. He would love to go back, but I don't think there's ever been that interest to bring him back, but. I mean, there was a time he was certainly over. Blackman tries to use the nunchucks, and he chokes Ken with them.
Oh, God.
Shamrock applies an armbar, but then just releases it and tosses the nunchucks away. I wonder where they landed. Lawler says that was pretty dumb to throw away those weapons.
I'll tell you, though, man. Like, Shamrock here was doing his pancreas work shoot MMA stuff. I mean, that style is really hot right now. I wouldn't mind seeing Ken Shamrock come back and work this style against a Kyle O'Reilly or something like that. You know what I mean? He'd be great.
Can he work that style today?
Yeah, I think so.
Ken?
A lot of it involves grappling. You know what I mean? So like, the guy looks amazing doing, or at least at this time, he looked great doing it. And it's unfortunate that when he was in the WWE, that style really was not around at all.
Ken gets a kendo stick, but Blackman then pulled out these sticks that I don't know what the proper name was. Crowd was chanting for Shamrock, but did feel somewhat restless. There was a DDT to Shamrock, both missed with head kicks. Then Blackman uses a kendo stick, hits him right on the head. The announcers explain that all Blackman has to do is walk out the door, but the referee is not opening it, which was...
Sorry, this is a cage match as well? Oh, well, they could climb out?
I don't think the announcers knew the rules of the match, which I don't know if the performers knew the rules of the match, because Shamrock makes his comeback with this belly-to-belly, attacks Blackman with a kendo stick, and Blackman is left lying on the mat. Shamrock is standing there, and the bell just rings. So he climbs out, poses on the perimeter of the cage, and that was it. Like, there was no count, there was no checking on Blackman, it was just he was down. Ken was up, and he basically shrugged his shoulders, and the match was over. I don't know what this was.
Honestly, it doesn't sound that much worse than a Punjabi prison.
Yeah, this was
It was, you know what, like, it kind of was, in essence, just a hardcore match without all the walking around the backstage. And they seemed to be hitting each other with these shots, not very softly, you know what I mean? I don't know how you would really work an Eskrima stick shot to the head. But it was certainly lacking in crowd reaction and drama, because I don't know if the crowd just simply couldn't see, or they just probably didn't care, or both.
Think about the fact that, you know, you have this audience that, even if they only paid $35, you've just watched one match on the big screen going across
backstage
to a bar.
Yeah.
And now you've got this, where I imagine the majority of the audience, their view is obstructed.
Uh-huh.
So I'd be a little annoyed that we've got these two matches on this one show. Kevin Kelly was backstage, and they did a recap of Shane McMahon attacking the ribs of Test on Sunday Night Heat. And Test storms past Kevin Kelly and says, "Talking time's over," which was always the best when it came to Test. Mm-hmm. That led to the Greenwich street fight between Test and Shane McMahon. The best visual of this whole show was Test coming out with his ribs taped up, but the tape was over top of his tank top.
Oh, of course. That's how every medical professional does it. You put the you tape up a man's ankle outside of his boot. You tape up an injury outside of their
he
gear.
Looked so ridiculous. I laughed out loud at this guy walking out with this.
Oh, that's silly.
This also had the stipulation of love her or leave her. If he wins, he must love this woman. And if he loses, he must leave her. Test had destroyed all members of the Mean Street Posse over the past month. Joey Abs, Rodney, and Pete Gass. And only Shane McMahon is left. Shane came out to a lot of heat, still using Vince McMahon's music. And at this time, this was when Austin had beat The Undertaker the prior month on pay-per-view, and Vince McMahon had to leave. So he was off television forever for another couple of weeks. And Shane had his custom jersey, which read on the back, "I just passed the test." And this was pre-wellness, so Shane was ahead of the curve.
I wonder if he's ever had to take a test.
I don't know. He's not a – I don't think he's a full-time performer, so
yeah.
We have to assume. Jim Ross then said a line that sounded just bizarre. "Shane made this a Greenwich street fight yesterday morning on Livewire." Good to know.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Mean Street Posse came out, selling all of their injuries from Test, and they sat front row on a couch. So for this 90-minute sellout, they got quite the arrangement here for front row seats at the last minute from Shane.
Yeah, couches.
Shane takes Test down and then mounted him. Test then reversed. They go to the floor. Test catches and power slams Shane as he jumps off the steps, and then the posse spit champagne at Test as he lifts Shane and press slams him onto the posse at ringside. And this led to Stephanie, who was backstage watching on a monitor, laughing at her idiot brother and his doofus friends. The posse then jumped Test in the crowd, and Shane gets a Mean Street Posse custom mailbox that was there and nailed Test in the head. Then we got customized weapons, a framed photo of Shane with the Mean Street Posse that they shattered over the head of Test. Test is rolled into the ring and he kicks out from this glass. And JR just says the question on all of our minds, "Can you imagine what Test must feel for Stephanie to endure this?" Shane then came off the top with this crazy corkscrew dive. I don't know what to call it.
This actually, they put this in the video game as part of Shane's moveset as well.
Oh, but, wow.
Yeah, this was like a corkscrew senton.
He missed Test, and then Test hit this power bomb, but Rodney distracted the ref. The posse then jumped Test. He was attacked with a road sign. He was placed onto the Spanish announce desk as Shane climbed to the top and put Test through with an elbow off the top, which set up our shocked Stephanie reaction shot.
How many times had he done the elbow from the through the announce table at
Bud? To be honest, I don't know if he had done it at all before this. Right. He may have. But he didn't do it at the WrestleMania before this with X-Pac. This might have been the first time he did it.
It's a spot that's now synonymous with him.
And hey, all credit to him doing this. Mm-hmm. I mean, the crowd was really hot for this. Yeah. I don't think they went in with high expectations for this. I mean, Shane had what would be at the time a fine match for 99 standards with Sean Waltman, but he was not facing Sean Waltman at SummerSlam. Test was not Sean Waltman.
Yeah.
So
you can argue who carried this match. It might have been Shane.
I mean, Shane killed himself in this match, as would be his calling card. The posse send Shane and Test back into the ring. They revive Shane with water, but Test kicks out to what was by far the biggest reaction so far on the show. The crowd was really into this. Pete Gass then misses with a sign and hits Shane. Joey Abs then pulls Shane by the leg to break up the cover. Rodney hits Test with a cast, put Shane on top for another near fall. Then Patterson and Briscoe run down. They eliminate the posse. Test hits Joey Abs with a big boot into a chair. Shane then runs into the corner. There's a pump handle slam to Shane, and then Test goes to the top for this huge elbow drop across the ring, and Test wins in 12 minutes and 14 seconds to a monstrous pop. Stephanie runs out. I thought this match was so well put together. These were two very limited performers in 1999, but you had the big story, and you had a happy ending.
Yeah.
Pardon the pun for this ending with the
what pun?
Well, it just happy ending is not usually used in the most literal of terms, but this was like the crowd was just happy to see Test and Stephanie together at the end of this match. They hugged. There was no screw job. Stephanie didn't low blow Test. It was just a nice moment. And JR says that Stephanie is free of Shane and can now live her life. And the replay, the highlight of this match was the replay of Stephanie running down the aisle in slow motion, like she was just called upon for The Price is Right. So this was, to many people, the match of the show, and I wouldn't disagree with you.
It was certainly the best match up until this point. The crowd was way more into it than any of their prior matches. It did a good job of making Test a sympathetic hero who had to overcome the odds of facing four guys in order to win the girl. I thought it had good spots, good crowd reaction, not much technical wrestling, but I don't think you come to a Shane McMahon match expecting that at all. I'm actually starting to become a pretty big fan of Shane, you know, even looking at some of this history stuff. Like, as long as you don't go in expecting technical wrestling, I think you'll have a good time.
Yeah, I think that I've certainly looked at Shane as certainly does bring value. And I think it's just being able to see what the limitations are and also that you don't raise them up to such a level that you're bringing down a top guy. That's why I hated that Randy Orton feud that year that Shane had him, because he shouldn't be going toe to toe with that guy. But under the right circumstance, I think for all intents and purposes, I think, you know, Shane and AJ Styles, I think that surprised a lot of people at WrestleMania this year.
But I think like this is the type of match that you do a Shane McMahon match with. And that's like a brawling match that you go all around the ring for, a bunch of creative spots, not 20 minutes inside a Hell in a Cell doing jujitsu and fake punching and kicking. That's, I think, what you don't want to see with Shane. But in this type of match, in this type of setting, I think he's great.
Then we got the bizarre video of how The Undertaker and Big Show formed an alliance, where Undertaker welcomed him under his wing by stating, "I hate everyone," and threatened to stab the Big Show in the heart.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. Sign me up.
And oh, that's nice.
This video also featured the Big Show military pressing Kane to the floor, which just looked awful. No one caught him. He just dumped him on the floor from the ring. X-Pac was the one guy that's been able to be trusted by Kane and show him what it's like to have a heart, which Kane responded to with the helpful use of his trusty voice box and stating, "Suck it."
I love that. I remember that moment where like Kane started to speak, and everybody like the next day in high school was like, "Wow, did you hear Kane talk? It was amazing."
I remember this crazy rumor at the time that I'm almost positive was bullshit, but there was this rumor that Kane had offered to actually have a voice box installed to really get the character over,
permanently in his.
Again, I don't believe I don't believe the story.
Does that technology even exist?
I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but I mean, imagine what they could have gotten out of this guy permanently having a voice box.
Where did you hear that? First of all,
probably in line at a WWF show.
Oh, you didn't check your sources? Didn't check with Dave? I'd love like a show of like people, like high schoolers, talking about wrestling rumors.
Oh, dude, they were the best.
Oh, man.
I remember always hearing, especially at like house shows or stuff, you'd be in the audience and you'd hear people just with the most craziest of shit. Let's see if anything comes up here. Kane voice box
surgery. You won't find anything. Oh, God.
Well.
Anyway. I don't even think that technology exists.
You probably
fucking
doesn't.
Install an electronic voice box in your throat.
Maybe the idea was to have just instead of – I don't know. I have no idea.
How about the rumor of Glenn Jacobs voluntarily burning his face to really get the character over? Did you hear that one?
Depends how committed he was, I guess. Yeah. Michael Cole's with X-Pac and Kane. And they state this is a mismatch. X-Pac says, this is a mismatch on paper. X-Pac says, this isn't paper. And there's no ass kicking he can't get up from. And him and Kane are closer than ever. And that's going to be the difference tonight.
Did you hear a Big Show and Undertaker's mashup theme?
Oh, I loved it. I had it here where they came out to like this.
It was actually kind of good. It was like a bluesy swing version of the Taker Ministry theme.
It was really weird, yeah. But we also had Kane's music that goes into X-Pac and their dual pyro for their entrance. Mm-hmm. This is where we were mentioning Taker's working with this groin injury. And Paul Bearer was in the corner of the Undertaker and Big Show. X-Pac, also the hometown guy from Minneapolis. All four fought as the bell rung, and Taker attacks the left arm of X-Pac. Kane then clotheslined Taker to the floor, who landed on his feet. X-Pac did the suck it sign and just immediately got back elbowed to the floor by Taker. There was a sign in the crowd that read, "Undertaker equals piss break." Taker and Kane, these two I thought had no heat together. I thought this was such a tired combination by the summer of 99.
They were fucking awful.
The crowd did get hot as Kane made his way to tag in X-Pac, who I felt was the most over guy in the match. Jim Ross admits he believes in Sean Waltman, although does not believe in Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. Taker runs X-Pac's balls into the post on the floor. Big Show then headbutted and applied a bear hug to Sean Waltman and his balls. The crowd rallied behind X-Pac. He bit his way out. X-Pac hit Big Show with a low blow and got super hot as Taker tried to pull him away. There's a low blow to Taker, and he makes the hot tag to Kane. There was a spin kick that sent Taker over the top to the floor, caught him on a pescado attempt, but then X-Pac runs him into the post. Bronco Buster to Big Show. He gets up. X-Pac turns around, gets hit with a big choke slam for a near fall as Big Show is just stepping on him for the pinfall attempt. Taker comes in and then just hits a tombstone, having to finish the Big Show's work for him, and pins X-Pac in his hometown in 12 minutes. And even though they win the tag titles, Taker's still pissed off at the Big Show.
Yeah.
All things considered, I was dreading watching this match as these guys were making their entrance. I didn't think this was a half-bad tag match.
I disagree.
I thought Waltman was great in this match. With Waltman and Taker, I thought were fine. And the less of Big Show and Kane, the better.
It was, I think, mainly that. It was very slow, especially when it was Kane and the Big Show, and then they start working a bear hug. I had no chance. This was the second time I fell asleep watching this pay-per-view. But certainly the crowd heat was really strong for X-Pac, and it was not a match with a typical X-Pac heat. It was genuine X-Pac heat.
Listen, there's no one that gets a worse rap than Sean Waltman. You go back, like, this guy was very, very good. And especially on this roster, dude, in 1999.
There's nobody that we, on this show, this podcast, that we always go back to and have nothing but praise for more than Sean Waltman. I think, you know, character-wise, say what you will, especially, you know, after this run, after DX ended. I think he all had a ton of issues. But in ring, he was always pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Ventura is then giving the rules to Steve Austin, who just walks away. As Ventura says, it's your title. It's your title. Then it was time for our semi-main event. Billy Gunn and The Rock in a Kiss My Ass match. Billy, our King of the Ring winner.
Only what, like 2 months prior?
2 months prior. Think of other King of the Ring winners and what that springboarded them into at SummerSlam. Gunn brings out this woman who is all covered up, and Billy says when he beats The Rock, he isn't kissing his ass. He's kissing this woman's ass. And it's this heavy woman underneath, which if you didn't realize her size, Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler pointed out for you that she is very heavy. King of the Ring winner, Billy Gunn.
Yeah.
This feud was also built up through such clever angles as Billy Gunn having his ass massaged with special oil that The Rock tampered with to give Billy Gunn poison ivy and have a irritated ass.
I feel bad for the masseuse.
I feel sorry for anyone that lived through this. The match begins. They fought up the aisle. Billy got sent into the side of the lion's den. They go back to the ring. Rock was sent into the steps. Rock put Jerry Lawler's crown onto the head of Billy Gunn and struck at him, spat water at him. Then Billy got the heat by nailing him with a ring bell. Rock came back with a float over DDT after being beaten down for several minutes. Gunn hit the Famouser. Then the woman rolls in. She stands in the corner and raises her skirt and has torn pantyhose. Rock stops Billy Gunn from putting his face into her ass and then puts Billy's face into, quote, that large woman's ass, as Jim Ross puts it.
Oh, Lord. Oh, God. Put the women put the children to bed.
She's got ripped pantyhose.
Put the children to bed. Oh, no. Oh, wait a minute.
A call that will not go on the reel. And Rock proceeds to hit a rock bottom and a people's elbow. Wins the match in 10 minutes and 12 seconds in one of The Rock's worst pay-per-view matches, in one of The Rock's worst programs in history, with one of the worst King of the Ring winners, and a horrendous program that was second from the top of SummerSlam. This was perhaps the worst match on the show because it was involving The Rock.
Mm.
By 2002, this guy was pretty much out the window, and we were wasting him with this shit.
What do you think The Rock is less proud of? This match or Baywatch?
This match.
Whoa.
This is awful.
Says it all. I hated
this so much. And when I look at things, like, granted, for whatever reason, in the summer of 1999, Billy Gunn was the project. And within a month, he was back to tagging with Road Dogg. So it tells you how that project panned out. But man, this was a prime spot on a major pay-per-view. And I just wonder what could have been if you had just chosen someone else. If Chris Jericho had come in and gotten a bigger push out of the get-go. If you had even gone with the Big Show to win the King of the Ring. Anything.
Dude.
This sucked.
For all we know, it could have been Chris Jericho in a Kiss My Ass match with Billy Gunn.
Well.
So I think he should be grateful he had what he had.
This is serious.
Could have been a lot worse.
This is seriously up there amongst the worst Rock. I would venture to guess the worst Rock program ever. Was his feud with Billy Gunn.
Yeah. The match I found awfully dull, but I hate to say it.
Oh, God, don't.
I didn't care until Billy Gunn brought the fat lady in. That was the high spot of this entire thing. And it certainly worked with this crowd, this 1999 crowd.
Oh, I hated every millisecond of this. I hated way. It was my lowest point of the show. Then we got our video preview for the main event and all of the changes over the past few weeks. Jesse Ventura comes out to a huge reaction and then cuts a promo on the goddamn media, who called him a disgrace for showing up here tonight. And he says, fuck you. I'm proud to be here tonight. And then we got the entrances, including Steve Austin. And this was the first night that he wore braces on both knees.
Wow. How did you get that stat?
Well, he had Jesse Ventura on his podcast and shared this story.
I don't know if you know about this to this day. So I was a part of that match. It was me.
Yeah, six men. Yeah, yeah.
Triple H.
Yeah.
In a triple threat match.
Yeah, yeah.
I hate those kind of matches.
I'd never seen one before, so it was new to me.
I loved tag team wrestling when I was with Brian.
Sure.
I come to love it. But I was always like a singles guy.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're in this triple threat. And I think Shane McMahon came ringside, and I was standing on the bottom rope, and he came by the ring, and I took a swipe at him. And when I did, that was the first night that I started wearing the double knee braces. I used to wear one, but now I was wearing double because the knees were so bad. Well, I tipped over and went upside down, and when I did, I hung myself in the ropes. So I'm hanging upside down by my legs. There's no way I can right myself back up. And so something just happened. Maybe it was something you did with Shane, but all of a sudden you go into a strut and I'm hanging upside down. I can't ask Mick or Triple H to, hey, help me out. I can't get out here.
Sure.
So as you're strutting, I'm hanging upside down going, Jesse, Jesse, Jesse. And you're caught up in the moment. We've got 20,000 people there. I'm hanging upside down on the top baby face in the world, and I'm screwed. And so finally, Triple H and me, who always had such a...
I don't even remember.
I know
this.
You didn't. But Triple H, he writes me up, and he had no business doing so because he's a heel.
Sure.
And this is one of those moments every now and then I'll botch a high spot or something with Triple H, who I loved working with. And right away, I had to start punching. I'm like, God dang it, God. Dang it, God dang it, but I'm using the other word.
Sure.
And we went to a whole high spot, but it was so embarrassing. It was just un-friggin' believable. And I'm like, Jesse, I'm just waiting. Man, you took care of me in 92 and down in WCW. Help me out in 99 to get me back on my feet.
I don't even remember it.
His feet are up in the air, and he's like fucking yelling to Jesse to help him get down. He's upside down, tied to the ropes, and Hunter comes over and saves him.
Oh,
it's amazing. You've got to hear this story.
Okay.
And then go back and watch this. It's so funny. Ventura noted, he also in the same interview noted this was the largest payoff of his entire career, which was very
Jesse
did. And this was very much debated at the time because when Owen Hart died, Jesse was promoting his book and he came out and he was very strong, against, you know, Owen doing this stunt that wrestlers shouldn't be – they're not stuntmen.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few weeks later, Jesse ends up signing this lucrative deal to do SummerSlam, and he does this press conference, and all of a sudden he's singing a much different tune and is not critical. He is not calling for a union of wrestlers. And a lot of people were talking about, should this guy be using his position in the office to get this great paying gig? And it was also how much they disclosed a figure of $100,000 that was just going to go to charity, with the idea that he was getting paid a lot more than that to do this. Hmm. So anyway, it was a big topic at the time. But I mean, the media story shifted from the Owen Hart death to Jesse Ventura. And I think that's a controversy the WWF welcomed much more if it meant moving past all the Owen Hart stuff. So Jesse was used very interestingly here in the summer. They also did the deal where they shot all the main event entrants walking backstage before their entrance. And this is where we got Hunter with his chain top that didn't really get over or be monetized. Huge reaction for Austin coming out. This was him at a gigantic high in popularity. Very fast start to the match. Austin is taken out on the floor to the announcer's desk. China pulls Mankind's legs between the post, and it leads to Ventura ejecting China. Austin then battles Hunter down the aisle into the lion's den. Hunter then attacks the bad knees of Austin. Mankind nails Hunter to the floor and then hit the somersault apron, which Hunter got out of the way of. Mankind, my God. In the Raw I watched where he comes back, this is after having knee surgery, which think about this at the time period. This guy's making more money than he ever has and had to take time off from knee surgery. So that probably tells you how serious it was. First match back, he's taking the knees into the steel step spot. It's crazy. Anyway.
It's like what you saw with Daniel Bryan when he came back. You know, the guy knew how to basically work that style. And unfortunate, he didn't have much more of a career after this either.
And I mean, there were a lot of guys, like top guys, hurt at this time that you think about the amount of money Austin was making that he would have to take. First of all, Austin was going into this match already hurt. He had this big knee injury. And that was part of the thinking of making this a three-way, was that the idea that he'd have trouble doing a singles match. And so he'd take time off for that, come back 2 months later, and then it was the neck was a wreck. Mm-hmm. And he had to, at his absolute drawing peak, had to take a year off. So it tells you how – and Taker, similar, had to take 9 months off. So a lot of guys were hurt at this point in the main event scene. Austin knocks Hunter over the barricade. They fought into the crowd as the audience is going crazy. Austin countered a pedigree, catapulted Hunter into Mankind, and then landed a stunner on Mankind as Hunter broke that up with a chair. Hunter then drills Mankind with a headshot using the chair, despite Ventura yelling at Hunter. So Hunter goes for the cover, and Jesse refuses to count. And the audience loved this, that Jesse was not going to count. Ventura and Hunter then tease going at it, and Shane McMahon runs in, and Ventura starts yelling at him, including uttering the word bullshit. Austin stuns Shane. Ventura then takes Shane and, in his lone physical spot of the match, tosses Shane to the ring, and then, very audibly, yells, "That's for your old man, you little bastard." Austin and Hunter are both down. This is also the spot where Austin gets stuck in the ropes. Mankind pulls out Socko, applies it to Austin and Hunter together. Austin kicks him low in his already injured balls. Austin stops a pedigree by clotheslining Hunter. Austin stuns Hunter. Mankind makes the save. Austin's back is turned, takes a pedigree. Mankind nails Hunter, and then Austin takes a double arm DDT, and you get the surprise win of Mankind pinning Austin at 16 minutes, 24 seconds, which the crowd, you could almost hear like this 5 seconds where they were processing Mankind is the champion, which a lot of people assumed Hunter was winning the title on this night. And so I think it was a little flat, but then they all suddenly realized Mankind was the winner and reacted appropriately. And that was the finish.
But for Mick Foley's second title win. Third title win.
And final title win.
Third and final title win. I think, like, you would expect it to be a bit more of a monumental moment. Instead, it was very anticlimactic, considering he was not a focused part of this storyline.
No.
He took a complete backseat to the post-match angle involving Austin and Hunter, and he was just kind of escorted out of there. It was a very kind of, not a very memorable title win.
Yeah, and I know at the time everyone was trying to look into, like, did Austin not want to drop the title to Hunter? And, you know, from all the research I did this past week, it seemed that it was never an issue of Austin putting over Hunter. It was a number of factors, the first of which making it a three-way because of the state of his knee at the time. And also, I mean, Austin took the fall here, and in future matches, I mean, he didn't seem to have any problem putting Hunter over, and I think it was more they wanted to surprise people. And on top of that, you have to remember how much coverage, especially in Minneapolis, this got, that the visual of Jesse Ventura raising the babyface's arm was probably a visual they wanted, as opposed to Jesse raising the heel's arm, which was a thing that they thought of at the time. Sure. And that was the visual you got. And it was very clever what they did at the end, because Jesse left with Mankind, raised his arm, went to the back, and then Hunter attacked Austin. Because had Jesse been in the middle of that, it would have forced Jesse to do something physical, and he was not going to do anything physical in this match. So that was the post-match angle. Hunter took out Austin's knee. That would explain his disappearance, or at least his time off, because he would do a guest referee stint the next month and then would be back for the October pay-per-view, and just gave him repeated chair shots to the knee. And of course, the next night on Raw led to Hunter beating Mankind to win the title, and they got to the desired Hunter title win just one night later.
Interesting. Interesting.
That was SummerSlam.
Yes, it was.
I'll say this. Going into this, I have never held SummerSlam 1999 in high regard. I still don't. There were some things on this show that I enjoyed more than I feel I did at the time. Mm-hmm. That said, Rock and Billy Gunn was even worse than I remembered it. So I still give this show I give it a 3.2 out of 10. Shane McMahon and Test was a high point. D'Lo Jarrett was okay. And I thought X-Pac and Undertaker's work in the tag match surprised me. I had no recollection of that tag match at all. That is the positive. And you know what? The main event was good, but did feel rushed, I felt, with the three-way nature. But that was that. That was SummerSlam 1999. Mm. Not one of the better SummerSlams. In fact, I would argue one of the bottom five, if not bottom three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm really not somebody who is somebody who looks back at the Attitude Era with any real fondness. If I do, it's for many of the moments that more so took place on Raw and less so on shows like this, where you actually kind of had to sit through the wrestling matches, which year 2000 were largely not all that memorable. You know what I mean? This show felt like any other show. It was a chore to sit through. No real redeeming matches. I'll say Shane and Tess, probably the best one. No real redeeming moments. Just NyQuil.
Wow.
So I give it a 3 out of 10 for a really hot crowd.
Wow. So I give it a higher rating by 0.2.
Yes, you did.
All right. Well, let's go to the message board, and we'll start off with Ryan from Calgary. This wasn't the worst SummerSlam, but there were some things on it that I had real trouble with. The worst thing on this card for me was the really gross way that JR and Jerry Lawler were talking about the woman that Mr. Ass brought out for The Rock to kiss on the ass. I think that JR would not be proud of himself, but Jerry the King Lawler is such a shitty person that I don't know how he'd feel. All right. He is bringing up the allegations that were made towards Jerry Lawler in 93, which were completely disproven. So whatever your opinion of Jerry Lawler is, the allegations that were made against him in 93 were totally thrown out, and the woman in question admitted as such. So
they're also playing roles that are designed for them.
Sure. His question here. The show had Chris Jericho, The Rock, Austin, Foley, Hunter, Undertaker, and X-Pac. Every single one of them an all-time great. Is the combination of talent, new ideas, and timing too rare a thing to happen again? What would have to shift in today's paradigm to allow for another expansion of the audience for pro wrestling? The talent is there, but there isn't one person on the roster today who is as over as the third best guy I mentioned a minute ago. And says SummerSlam 93 to 95 were all much worse than this. 95. Well, 93 I'll grant you that. 93 was probably a worse card. 94 had a match with Bret and Owen that blew away anything on this show. And 95 had the ladder match with Michaels and Scott Hall that also blew away anything on this show to me. If you're, what was your best match on this show?
Shane and Tess.
Yeah, like to me, there's no comparison of that match to Michaels and Scott Hall's ladder match at SummerSlam 95. So in that sense, I would say 93, you'd have an argument, but not 94 or 95. In terms of big talent, I mean, the WWF has stars today. It doesn't have the level of popularity they did of 1999.
Yeah. You don't have The Rock, though. You don't have Steve
Austin. You don't have anyone at that level.
No. And maybe it's the timing of the tastes of the world right now. I mean, there are a lot, wrestling has a lot of fans, but maybe the mainstream just doesn't have the appetite for professional wrestling.
Yeah. And Austin and Rock were just at such a high, like John Cena's a huge star. Mm-hmm. He's not at the level of Austin in 1999.
No. We go to Terry from Mid-South Wales, but soon hailing from Shenzhen, China. First of all, allow me to pass my congratulations on to John for his being a new dad. To answer your question, no, SummerSlam 99 is hardly the worst SummerSlam in history. There are problems, sure, with short matches and with the horrible objectification of women, but I still walked away entertained. It's wonderful to revisit awesome, compelling characters and memorable, for better or worse, moments that we don't see enough of nowadays. To me, the show stands out as a teaser for what would be arguably the greatest year in WWF history in 2000, while saying farewell to the raunchier early days of the Attitude Era. Acts like Edge and Christian, the Hardys, and the main event Triple H were coming to fruition, while it was nearly time to say a meaningful goodbye to Jeff Jarrett, D'Lo Brown, and Ken Shamrock.
Okay, we go to Christian. The main thing I remember from this show is the Test Shane street fight. Much like many of Shane's matches, it was full of big bumps and lots of hardcore action that did help make Test look great by the end of it. Besides that, there really wasn't much else to the show. It wasn't awful, but it wasn't great. What I want to ask you guys is, what do you know about the backstage story involving the WWF title match on the show? Kind of went over that. Anyway, so... okay. That was that.
All right, we got a McWhalen who wants to know, I recall asking John about 3 years ago what was the worst SummerSlam, and the first one that he said was 99. The opener was good and actually had a bit of historical importance, as this was the start of Jarrett's IC run that led to him holding Vince up before losing to China at No Mercy. As for Deborah's popularity, maybe you two could explain it to me, as I still have trouble wrapping my head around it to this day.
She was hot.
The other standouts on the card were Tess versus Shane, which I do recall coming in third for match of the year in 99 between Bret and Benoit, and Nitro and the Hardys versus Edge and Christian at No Mercy. It was a great match, but this was pretty much the peak for Tess in terms of popularity. The other notable match was The Rock and Billy Gunn, which was not that good, and the stuff with the large woman just hasn't aged well.
All right, we go to Jonathan. China cutting a promo is always pretty entertaining. For the wrong reasons. Don't know if you noticed, but the promo has a weird mix of dance and military style music in the background. Do you think Vince and Kevin Dunn couldn't decide which CD to use? 90s party anthems or the best of World War I? I think sometimes people look on the Attitude Era too fondly. When you look at the quality of matches, today's pay-per-views, they seem much stronger. However, it's hard to deny the audience are a lot more invested in the main event wrestlers from the 90s. Do you ever think Linda McMahon will be seen in an on-air role with WWE again? I do not. Lastly, I saw an interview Ken Shamrock did saying he can't understand why WWE hasn't used him in the last few years. Why do you think it is they haven't brought him back? And if they did bring him back, what role would you like to see him in? I really don't see a role for Ken Shamrock in today's WWE climate. And Linda McMahon, I don't think you'll ever see her in a on-air kind of position in WWE again.
Robbie from London, Ontario. Maybe I'm used to the recent women's division, but the constant referring to Deborah as the puppies alone is pretty bad here. I did enjoy D'Lo's running Liger Bomb, but three turns in one match, that's a little much. Not a bad little match, though. Tag team turmoil started nicely with Edge and Christian versus the Hardys. Everything that followed, not so much. The best of the division involving Albert, Draws, and Viscera Midian is never a good sign. Question... What is your favorite SummerSlam of all time?
Favorite SummerSlam of all time? 2002 would be up there.
Yeah, that's mine.
2001 was a pretty good show as well. I mean, when you look at like 2001 to 2003, I mean, the roster was just so deep with talent. But 2002 to me stands out.
Yeah, and as far as like especially 2002, at least on the SmackDown side, I mean, a lot of the storylines weren't really insulting like they were on a show like this. And good wrestling.
All right, next up is John. While the WWE was at their apex popularity-wise, SummerSlam was just like all the pay-per-views from that year, slow, forgettable, and boring. For me, it's one of the worst SummerSlams of all time, as I really don't have the desire to rewatch this particular show. WWF pay-per-views from 93 to 1996 often get criticized. However, at least they have a nostalgic charm to them, whereas I believe that 99 was the worst year for WWE pay-per-views.
Sean from Manchester, England. What a mediocre show this was. On paper, the main event seemed like a really good match, but you had a heel who wasn't as over as the company had hoped and wouldn't be until he defeated Cactus Jack in early 2000, and two baby faces were crooked. X-Pac, who was about as good as anybody else in the company at the time, was wasted in the tag match, especially given the fact that his opponents were an unmotivated Big Show and an Undertaker who was a physical wreck. I remember a lot of talk at the time was that he was ready for retirement. Speaking of being wasted, why on earth was The Rock racing Billy Gunn? Off the top of my head, this was probably the worst SummerSlam ever. At least in 1988, you had two very good tag team matches with the Bulldogs and against the Rougeaus and the Hart Foundation facing Demolition, both of which were miles better than anything on this show.
All right. Well, that wraps it up. Thank you, folks, for your feedback and our look at SummerSlam 1999. What a trip down memory lane.
Uh-huh.
For a show that we will never watch again in our lifetimes.
Don't say that. You never know. I never know why we might have to come back to this.
Maybe there'll be that night I wake up at 4 a.m. I can't sleep, and I just decide to throw on the Kiss My Ass match. Well, imagine where things would have gone if Vince Russo had stuck with the company. Would we have had a Kiss My Ass The Best Of DVD? Would we have gotten there?
Yeah, that's a very interesting what if. Or I guess, I don't know. Eventually you move on to other body parts.
Yeah. I mean, Vince McMahon did take the idea and ran with it, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. He did.
So there was definitely legs to the ass gimmick.
Yeah.
Well, in 2 weeks, it will be Friday, August the 25th. Myself and Wei, we are just going to be glued to the coverage of Mayweather-McGregor, that we are going to hand off the reins of Review Away to two members of the Law family. Braden Harrington and Bartender Dave are going to be handling Review Away in 2 weeks. And what are they reviewing, Wei?
They will be watching Pure Country, Pure Heart. This is, of course, the brand new film starring Willie Nelson and Michael Hickenbottom.
Awesome. I have zero desire to watch this, so I'm glad that Braden and Bartender Dave will be doing
Braden so. Braden and Dave were very happy to do it. And in fact, there are a lot of people looking forward to these two watching this film, and I certainly am one of those people. I'd love to hear these two talk about what is this movie even about? Can you look up the description of this Pure Country, Pure Heart?
Yeah, let's find out what it has, the plot points.
Pure Country, Pure Heart. Is this a WWE Studios production?
Yes, they are, of course, involved.
Yes.
With such a okay, let's see. IMDb. Look at that, a 7.2 out of 10 rating so far. Is this the right match?
Yeah.
Is that it?
There's no description? Oh, okay. No.
Let's keep looking. We're going to find this.
It's not even got a synopsis.
It's on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, man.
Do we have any reviews in?
Plot unknown.
Oh, that's even better.
Okay, well, I guess... Okay.
It's received one review.
I got something.
Okay.
Pure Country, Pure Heart is the third installment in the Pure Country series.
Oh, Jesus.
It's a story of teen sisters who head to Nashville to learn more about their late father, a Marine who died in Iraq. When they discover his secret past life as a musician, they are inspired to follow their own dreams of becoming singer-songwriters. It's got everything. A great country soundtrack, a Nashville setting, naturally, and Willie Nelson.
Oh, what more could you ask for?
Not much about Shawn Michaels here, but I can only assume he'll have a memorable role. Well, enjoy that.
What an endorsement. All right, we're going to end off the show with what was promised earlier. Probably the worst promo in The Undertaker's career. It was from the Raw going into SummerSlam, where The Undertaker took the microphone and for what felt like the next hour told the most ridiculous, wandering story. Where it went, I have no clue. When you think it can't get any worse, he finds ways to do it. Here it is, The Undertaker, with the Big Show in the ring. He takes us to the desert where we all die of boredom and exhaustion.
Playtime's over, sit down and shut up. Later on tonight, there's going to be a match for the tag team titles between the Acolytes and X-Pac and Kane, whatever, whatever, it's not important.
That's right. Exactly, it's been signed for tonight.
The fact of the matter is, this Sunday at SummerSlam, the winner of that match will come face to face with this.
Man, that's... Well, I don't think... I didn't realize that The Undertaker and The Big Show this Sunday together.
And to make sure that my man was right, this week I put him to the test. I had Paul Bearer call out to California, San Fernando Valley, to some associates of ours at the local 81.
What's that?
Paul said we're going to need two bikes for a ride into the desert. The guy said, Brother Paul, now we know the dead man can handle it, but I don't know about the Big Show. It's August. It's 120 degrees in the middle of Death Valley. He says the only thing that survives in Death Valley are the cold-blooded, the snakes and the lizards. Paul said, that's all right. And in one of those bikes that you're setting up for us, I want the Big Show only to have enough gas to get to the middle of the desert and not get back.
What?
So we're on our way. We get to the middle of Death Valley, 120 degrees. The Big Show's bike runs out of gas. And I pull up next to him and I ask him this question. It's 120 degrees. How are you going to survive? He looks me straight in the eyes. Without a hesitation, he says, I'm going to wait till you go to sleep. I'm going to stab you in the back. I'm going to cut your flesh off, make a coat out of it, and I will eat your flesh until I find food.
Ugh.
I said, good answer, big man, but I don't sleep. And I drove off and left him.
What?
I waited on the outskirts of the desert. 2 days later, he comes walking out with a snake necktie and lizard boots, carrying his Harley Davidson on his shoulder.
He's big enough.
The point of the story is this. What used to be known as SummerSlam will now be known as Armageddon, and whoever shows up will be hurt.
Wow. That is a straight-out warning.